Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hi Richard.
And back from his travels, Lionel Burney.
Hello Richard.
Lionel, first of all, thank you very much for having Daniel and me back on the podcast after your little breakaway effort with Ciro last week.
It's a pleasure. Ciro was good, wasn't he? A very able stand-in.
Too able, I think. I think we'll be hearing from Ciro again. So we're going to talk in this week's podcast about Paris-Nice and look ahead to Milan-San Remo, touch lightly on Tirreno Adriatico as well. We're going to hear from Rod Ellingworth, the Team Sky race coach, Tommy Eltras-Slagter of Garmin-Sharp, Eric Zabel, speaking about Milan-San Remo, and Simon Gerrans, also on Milan-San Remo.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So, Lionel, you're just fresh off the plane from Paris-Nice. And as I say, thanks for having us back on. That was a very interesting podcast with Ciro last week. We enjoyed it on the road. So tell us, you were on the race the whole way. The race was won in the end by Carlos Betancur. A great race, exciting race, everyday interesting course, no time trial, which I think made those road stages perhaps even more aggressive and exciting, arguably, than they might otherwise have been. Great to see, personally, Arthur Vichot win the final stage in Tennis on the Promenade des Anglais yesterday, as we speak. He's been a rider who's progressed just a little bit every year and is now perhaps ready to get some of the big wins, part of a very strong team as well. But Betancur winning for Agir d'Azur, a team that has not had many winners over the last few years. A good race for French teams, French cycling.
Yeah, certainly for Francaise d'Azur and for AG2R. Francaise d'Azur started off very well with Nasser Bouhanni winning the opening stage and keeping the yellow jersey for a day. And then, of course, Arthur Vichot, who was up there every day, forced his way onto the podium at the end in the French national champions jersey. And in fact, Prudhomme made the point afterwards that the podium had the yellow jersey, of course, of Betancur, the rainbow jersey of the world champion Rui Costa in second place, and the French national champions jersey. From that point of view, I think Prudhomme was very happy with the makeup of the podium. And there was a sort of general air amongst the riders and the staff that all of the sort of pre-race debate about whether or not there should be a time trial in a stage race like Paris-Nice, The conclusion was it was a really hard race. They raced hard. It was aggressive. It was competitive. It was up for grabs, really, up to the end. There were quite a lot of racing incidents in terms of, you know, crashes and people, particularly Tom Eltras-Slagter, who would have probably been up there on the podium had he not had that mechanical problem on the Stage de Fayence, where a rider who I gather was Wilco Kelderman ran into his rear derailleur and basically jammed his gears. So, you know, there was plenty to talk about. But I think the most important thing from the spectator's point of view was that you didn't really know what was going to happen each day. And the attacks that happened, particularly towards the end of stages where the GC was being fought out, were exciting.
Do you see much of Paris-Nice, Daniel?
I did, Rich. Absolutely. Enjoyed it. I think we've talked before about how what on paper may seem like fairly innocuous routes can lead to very exciting racing. It's pretty much a blank canvas for the riders to impose the kind of for the spectacle.
Paint pretty pictures.
Yeah, exactly. And it generally makes for a very hard race as well, because there's no sort of intimidation factor, there's no fear factor before the stages, in contrast to, for instance, Tirreno Adriatico with yesterday's stage at Tirreno, Sunday stage, for instance, with the that horrific finish. It tends to make the first 2 or 3 hours of racing fairly benign, whereas Paris-Nice, it was aggressive the whole time. It was, very exciting. And I imagine a lot of riders would have come out of that race absolutely flying for San Remo. We've talked about before how the winner of San Remo has tended to come from Tirreno in recent years, but I imagine there are a lot of guys with very good form after such a hard Paris-Nice.
Not least Rui Costa, who was unlucky, crashing on the final stage. He came second on a couple of occasions, finished second overall, seemed to be riding very well, made a lot of friends, must be the friendliest bloke on Twitter. He seems to be pals with all the...
I don't think he does his own tweets, though, Rich.
You don't think so?
No, I really don't.
No?
We'll get to the bottom of that mystery before the end.
We'll find that out, but he's... He's sort of the friendliest guy on Twitter. I'd love to know if he has any enemies out there. But he looks in fine form, and he, you know, he's a dark
horse. Carlos Barredo, he's certainly an enemy. He was an enemy of
well remembered
Rui Costa. Certainly a different.
Perhaps you can tell our listeners about the incident between.
When was it? 2010 Tour de France. End of a fairly nondescript stage in the first or second week, and there was a big dust up, wasn't there?
Yeah.
At the end, the wheels being thrown, punches being thrown. Barredo, I think he wasn't thrown out of the race, was he? But he got some kind of time penalty.
Yeah, it's always great to see bike riders fighting with their cleats on. It's a very undignified spectacle. Graceless. Anyway, actually, Bruhani, you mentioned, is a big boxing fan, we learned last week, and was reading Mike Tyson's biography. Did you learn anything about Bruhani last week at all, Lionel?
Only what Chiro told me about him being a very big boxing fan and being a big fan of Mike Tyson.
Not only is he a boxing fan, he actually still boxes in the off-season. Yeah.
Team Sky, Geraint Thomas, I mean, you mentioned the blank canvas, and you know he took off with Slagter on a... Which stage was it again, Lionel? Remind me.
That was the stage four to Belleville.
So it wasn't a stage on paper that looked like it would be a decisive stage, but he really seized the initiative that day and took the overall lead. Lost it, but he was still up there. Could he have finished on the podium had he not crashed on Saturday?
Yeah, he probably would have done, but bearing in mind he might not have won the second of his two stages because they would have obviously marked him
Thomas.
I don't know about winning it, but I think he was certainly on for the podium, yeah. I mean, the problem he had was that he was going to have to try and take back that 5 seconds on Betancourt on either the penultimate stage where obviously he crashed on that downhill sort of sweeping corner, which was a bit deceptive because there was a couple of those corners that seemed to catch people out the first time round. And then, you know, the crash, which we didn't actually see on the TV, and we just saw the aftermath of it with Thomas wedged under the barriers and Frank Schleck at the heart of it as well. Thomas... You know, he was right in the mix for a podium place, but Betancourt's sprinting was pretty handy. And I think, although Sean Kelly said, you know, it might all come down to the Promenade des Anglais on the last day, and if Thomas can win the time bonus and win the stage, even in a group of that size, you know, would Thomas have been able to win the stage to get the biggest possible time bonus? It's debatable.
I don't know about you, Lionel, but I thought it was a bit of a red herring, the fact that, you know, he was still in touch after stage six to Fiance because he was really being run ragged towards the end of that stage and was really just hanging on, I thought, at the finish that day.
Well, he was, but you've got to bear in mind that for 2 days running, very dangerous breaks went away, both with Chavanel and a number of other really strong riders. I think on that particular day, the break was quite big. Sky had to burn a lot of matches to keep that gap sort of manageable, and so then Thomas was really left only with Lopez when it came into the run into that climb, and it was incredibly steep. It was Mur de Huy, which is the climb from Flèche Wallonne. It was comparable to that, but a much rougher surface. I didn't expect him to be that close to the back of Betancourt at the finish there. I thought that was probably his ride of the week, but I did actually speak to Rod Ellingworth on Sunday morning before the final stage from Nice to the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, to find out what the extent of Geraint's injuries were and to find out exactly how the crash happened. So this is Rod Ellingworth, Team Sky's race coach. We didn't see the crash actually happen on TV yesterday. Do you know what happened? Did Geraint tell you exactly what happened?
He's not 100% sure. He said he sent somebody come right across the front of him and just hit the wheel and off he went. So, and then... Bobby Juliet rang me last night and said, "How's G?" And he said that he was watching on TV and noticed a big flick down the line, and then the next shot was them laid on the floor. So, don't 100% know. I think it sounds like somebody's come across the front of him and he's gone down, you know. So,
it looked like the pace wasn't fully on at that point, and the group had kind of swelled out across the road, and as it went round that slight, perhaps deceptively, left-hand bend that. Yeah. The flick went across the road. Do you think it's a matter of not ideal positioning for him or just being in...
No, he chose... I think he was behind Rui Costa and he chose to sit there, actually. And moments before, Nico had said to him, "Good wheel, you know, we're happy with that." So, yeah, it wasn't like the group was that big, was it, you know? and it wasn't like they'd not been down there before. So I think it was a racing incident and... unfortunately, G came out as the bad one. Yeah, which was massively disappointing for us. You know,
obviously he was looking pretty much set for a podium position. Really, yes, it would have been an unusual kind of blow up had he not been up in that front group yesterday, and today he probably could have coped with the final stage over the Col d'Huez.
I think tactically, in a way, we were just doing enough yesterday, and then today was a big day, you know, and I think G was showing good form. I don't think he would have blown up. I think we were prepared to go full ball for the win and potentially come away slightly from GC, but you know, he was going to race hard, that was for sure.
And what about his injuries? Fortunately, nothing broken.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing. Nothing's broken. I think everybody could see, and as I always say, I've known G a long, long time, and if Geraint sits on the floor, you know he's hurt himself. He doesn't sit down for no reason, and he actually said it, he was laid underneath that barrier and was laid there thinking, ow, I've done something bad here, you know. But he, fortunately, nothing broken, but he is battered and bruised quite a bit, you know, and he's a bit sore this morning, so he's not taking the start today.
And in terms of, with Milan Sanremo only a week away, will you be err on the side of caution rather than sort of rush back into a race that, you know, that long in the saddle, see how the bruising comes out over the next few days?
Well, you know, if you take away the crash, you pretty much not do a lot between now and then anyway. You know, his form, he's shown he's got good form. Training wise, you're not going to make any difference. If anything, you can mess it up by overdoing it. So anyway, it would be a recovery stroke maintenance sort of period. I think it's just day by day, you know, and you know, we always say nothing serious, everything else, but sometimes I always believe 2 days later is the worst time. So tomorrow will be the big day where he really will feel pretty bad, and he's got quite a lot on his back and he's got quite a bit of skin off, so infections or whatever else. I mean, the doctor's done a good job cleaning him up, but I think Luke even scrubbed him down in the shower last night, apparently.
what a lovely image, yes, taking us inside.
Two Welsh boys looking after each other. I did laugh, but I did say to G, I said, well, if he don't do it, I'm going to do it. And G sort of, really, okay. Yeah, so anyway. Yeah.
You'd be in there with the wire wool, though, wouldn't you?
I've done it before. I've done it before, and I gave them a flannel to bite on. That's true, that. Well, should ask Andy Tennant, yeah.
I mean, I suppose it just occurs to me, we're talking about a rider who rode almost all of the Tour de France with a fractured pelvis. So I presume it will be him that will have the sort of the bulk of the say and the decision as to when he comes back to racing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, he's the one who's hurt. You know, we can't tell him if he's hurt or not. But, you know, knowing G, I think he looks okay to me this morning. I think high chance he's going to be fine for Milan Sanremo. You know, and he's in good fettle, and I think logically he knows he's in good form, so he'll be fine, I think. But you never know.
What are the positives from this week then? Because Geraint said he was loving racing, the open racing like a junior. Yeah. Like you said, they're picking and choosing the right wheels to be on and marking the moves that you could, knowing that you couldn't go with everything. So do you think he's probably come out of this having learned and taken a lot of experience from being at that level?
Yeah, and I think Geraint knows he can win Paris-Nice, you know, if he'll come back another year and definitely try and win it, you know. And he even said to me last night, I'm going to win this next year, you know. So he wants to win some. You know, this was what his next progression is, really, in a way, isn't it? The 1 week or 8 day stage racing. So, yeah, he'll give it a good go, and I'm sure he'll bounce back pretty quick, I think.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Free.
So that was Rod Ellingworth just telling us a little bit about Geraint Thomas and his injuries, and sharing with us the lovely image of Luke Rowe scrubbing him down in the showers after his crash wins. Rod is a notoriously sort of tough taskmaster. He used to run the British Cycling Academy, of course. I do remember him telling me a story about Geraint Thomas who, during a racing trip to the Alps, when he crashed and took all the skin off his hands because he slid down the road on his hands. The next morning he came down for breakfast wearing a tracksuit, and Rod said to him, Geraint, where's your racing kit? Why are you not in your kit? And he said, well, look at my hands. And Rod said, you don't pedal with your hands. So that was that's Rod Ellingworth, perhaps the most sympathetic of people. But it did look a heavy crash. I mean, remember Geraint Thomas finished the Tour last year with a broken pelvis. He's not somebody who's likely to pack in a race easily. And he was sort of crumpled on the road. He did look seriously injured. Watching the footage of the descent, it did seem quite chaotic and messy just before the crash happened. I was surprised that he got back up and finished 7 minutes down, but obviously didn't start the next day. But a disappointing race for Team Sky, and similarly at Tirreno Adriatico, Richie Porte has pulled out. They've not got much from these two races, have they?
Well, no, they haven't, but, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? A week is a long time in cycling. This time last week, everyone was kind of thinking, well, maybe they'll be nailed on for victory in Tirreno Adriatico with Richie Porte. And then when Geraint got the jersey in Paris-Nice, everything was looking so good. And then a crash kind of rules Geraint out, and Porte gets ill in Tirreno, and suddenly it's kind of, it's doom and gloom, which is probably a bit of an overreaction, but the point you make there about it being chaotic when Geraint crashed, again, the racing was aggressive, so there weren't teams that had big strength in numbers in those groups. It was kind of like two, possibly three guys from each team. So as Geraint said in the press conference earlier in the week, it was like junior racing almost. And I think that's what Prudhomme and Thierry Gouvenou were looking for when they plotted the race for Paris-Nice without the time trial. It wasn't predictable. It was a bit chaotic at times, and I think one of the things that impressed me most about Carlos Betancourt was that, firstly, that AG2R managed to rope in quite a lot of help from Europcar under the guise of Europcar working for who? I mean, Vauclair was bang out of form. And
quite unusual, that, isn't it? Quite unusual for French teams to...
Yeah, I mean, you know, they clearly collaborated. For what reason, it's not entirely clear, because Europcar didn't get anything out of that, and weren't likely to get anything out of that. But AG2R were smart. They, you know, if that was a favour, they'd called in from something previously for last year, or just some hope that help they roped in. You know, they that was smart. And Betancourt, his positioning was very unconventional at times, particularly the race towards Fayence.
Unconventional or rubbish? Absolutely rubbish.
Or typically Colombian.
Yeah.
Well, it could, yeah, a combination of all three. It was, yeah, you're right, it was terrible positioning at times. Although, having said that, when Geraint crashed on that descent, Betancourt had been a lot further forward that day, whereas the stage to Fayence, where he sat on the back and all the splits were opening up, that was a real gamble for him. But, presumably he was confident that he was going to get up that hill quicker than most.
Yeah. How good is Betancourt, Daniel?
Well, he's got impeccable pedigree. He sort of burst onto the scene in 2009, won the Baby Giro, and 2010. The year before that, he finished second in the under 23 World Championships behind Romain Sicard. You remember, on the very difficult course in Mendrisio. He's got the reputation of being fairly mercurial, kind of slightly inconsistent. Tends to put on a lot of weight. Put on a lot of weight last year after a very good Giro, was pretty awful at the Vuelta last year, put on a lot of weight again this winter. In fact, Vincent Lavenu, the AG2R manager, said even this week that he was still 5 kilos overweight. So the sort of mind boggles at how good he might be if he loses some of that weight when he does the tour. I think he's going to co-lead the team with Jean-Christophe Perrault. But yeah, his positioning was poor, Lionel. That stage to Fayence, as AG2R were fortunate to be very well represented in that front group that day, but they wasted a lot of resources. Okay, only over the course of a few kilometres, but they wasted a lot of resources dragging him back and bridging a gap that really shouldn't have been allowed to open up. But they look interesting this year. They've got a couple of good young French riders as well. It wouldn't be the Humans Event podcast if I didn't mention a young French climber. But Alexis Villermoz, the new name to conjure with. He was very impressive in Paris-Nice, a young French climber from the Jura region.
I mean, what's interesting is that the first Colombian to win Paris-Nice, and he's a climber, but it wasn't a mountainous race. It wasn't a race that really suited a climber in a sense. He did make the difference, obviously, on those little short explosive climbs, Daniel.
Yeah, it was very much a route that, with the presence of, or with there being time bonuses, it was very much a route which suited a punchy climb, someone with a fast finish, yeah. Basically. It was the kind of route that someone like Dewey mentions Danilo De Luca would have loved in his pomp.
He would have indeed. Yeah, I mean, so perhaps the extra weight wouldn't have been so much of a handicap on those types of climbs as well. I guess the real test for Betancourt will come in the Grand Tours. for him this year? Is it Giro or Tour?
It's the Tour with Perrault as the co-leader. But, I mean, just going back to the route, if there was a weakness of the route, and I thought it yielded a very exciting race, but if there was a weakness, it wasn't a complete test of cycling in that there weren't really any long climbs, were there?
No. Did we see much of... I mean, we saw quite a bit of Vincenzo Nibali, but not trying to win the race. Did he impress over the week, do you think?
I mean, on numerous occasions, Lionel will be able to confirm he tried to use what opportunities the terrain presented, which weren't great for a rider of his characteristics. And he had a few digs kind of at the end of stages. There were a lot of stages which were actually quite good dress rehearsals for Milan-San Remo, because there was a descent and then, you know, a 10-kilometre flat running. And you can almost imagine Nibali doing his usual sort of cliché trick of trying to attack over the Cipressa or the Poggio at the weekend. And he tried that a couple of times at Paris-Nice, and you need huge horsepower to be able to resist a big group, which it always was at Paris-Nice on run-ins like that. But, I mean, he's always near... enough the right weight. Nibali never puts on a lot of weight. He's a little bit behind in his training preparation compared to previous years, but he certainly looks in decent fettle.
He's wasting a lot of energy at the moment just trying to shake off Ciro, I think. Yeah. That's taking up most of his energy at the moment. Now, I think I don't think we can call him a revelation, because he won the Tour Down Under last year, Tom Jelter Slachter, but he has moved to Garmin Sharp this year. He probably didn't build on that success at Tour Down Under last year, because I think it was known quite early that he was moving teams, and I don't think Belkin gave him too many opportunities, did they? But he's a very exciting looking climber stroke sort of puncher. He was a good finisher. I mean, the stage he was away with Geraint Thomas, admittedly Thomas had been going mainly for GC that day, but he finished him off quite easily in the sprint, and won a second stage as well, and may have won the race overall had it not been for the mechanical incident. I think you spoke to him, Lionel, am I right?
Well, yeah, I asked him in the press conference after his second stage win, because it was still a little unclear how he'd lost the 1 minute 34 at Fayence the previous day, and he explained how that happened. So here is Tom Jelter Slachter after his second stage win.
Yesterday everything went perfect till I think 3k before the finish, 4k to go. Before the climb, someone hit my back wheel. I felt that, and I heard some noise that someone hit me, and I actually stayed on the bike and did the climb. I attacked, and at the hairpins, and at that moment my derriere broke off, and so I was done directly. And at that moment I knew it was because of the guy touched me before, and from that moment the classification was over, and it was really frustrating. Everything was lost except the win from the day before. So this morning it was a little bit hard to switch the mind in the head and go again. But once we came on the final laps here, I saw it was perfect for me, and the guys did a really good job to put me in front at the finish, and it worked out well. I was good enough again, so I'm the happiest man.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
That was Tom Jelter Slachter. Now we have a signed Garmin Sharp jersey, signed by all the riders from Paris-Nice, to give away as part of a competition this week, and we'll be asking you a question at the end. But Lionel, on Slachter, Garmin Sharp, what were your impressions of them at Paris-Nice?
Well, they were coy at the start of the week about what their cards were going to be. Obviously, last year, Andrew Talansky was second overall. Talansky not riding at Paris-Nice this year. Looking at the roster on paper, it didn't look like there was going to be an obvious candidate. And Slachter, you just never know, do you, when somebody's won a race like Tour Down Under, 13-14 months ago, there's no real indication that means they're going to be on for a good performance this week. But the way he rode for his first stage win was impressive, and he was fully in the mix before that mechanical problem, and then to bounce back from that and win a second stage and then still be up there with the leading group on the last day as well. A couple of the Dutch journalists that I spoke to on Paris-Nice say he is next goal will be Milan-San Remo, and then perhaps the Ardennes Classics,
And he's very, very small. He's very punchy. He can sprint. He can climb. You know, I think we'll be hearing a lot more about him later on in the spring, perhaps.
You know, not dissimilar. They've got a few riders like that, Garmin-Sharp, haven't they? They're building up a collection of quite small, strong climber, puncher type riders, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they've got Sebastian Langeveldt for the cobbled classics, particularly the Tour of Flanders and perhaps Amstel Gold, but maybe not Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Slakta dovetails with Dan Martin, who of course won Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year. So yeah, they've got some very quietly, they seem to keep their team evolving and new names come to the fore all the time.
It's funny because a few years ago they were very much a team of rulers, you know, team time trials were their thing, and they've still got a few strong rulers. But we watched the Tirreno at the weekend, Ben King on the attack, and he again is a different shape of rider, different, you know, looks like a climber. Was in the break with Alberto Contador, and you know, looks like a decent climber, but the shape of the team in a literal sense is perhaps changing.
Well, yeah, I mean, before sort of Dan Martin's kind of emergence, obviously won a Pyrenean stage in the Tour last year. You know, they didn't really, and obviously Heyerdahl as well, winning the Giro. You know, they've built a team. Jonathan Vaughters there has built a team that has been able to. A bit like Bob Stapleton did when he identified that they could win a lot of races with just quick, fast riders. And, you know, people like Bernie Eisel, obviously Cavendish when he was young, you know, Bösenhagen. And they haven't been as dramatic about it, Garmin-Sharp, but quietly they have built a team of riders who can win races.
Yeah, and I think very much like Bob Stapleton, Jonathan Vaughters felt that it was impossible to win, or very unlikely that they were going to win major tours in that period for, you know, whatever reason. Jonathan Vaughters might say it was because he didn't feel that perhaps it was a level playing field in the major tours. But I think now the shift in emphasis in their team, the shift in emphasis towards climbing major tours maybe reflects that he believes there has been a major change. They also don't have a top-class sprinter, and that is where their roster at the moment is actually lacking.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So let's turn our attention from France to Italy, and Tirreno Adriatico is ongoing. It's not quite finished as we speak, and look ahead to Milan-San Remo this Sunday. What we've seen so far in Tirreno Adriatico is a resurgent Alberto Contador, who is apparently training with Stephen de Jong, the former Team Sky director. Interesting, he wasn't a coach at Team Sky, but he has become a coach at Tinkoff Saxo. Keep wanting to say Tinko Saxoff, which a few commentators have been saying. Anyway, Alberto Contador has been absolutely rampant. As we speak, he leads by over 2 minutes. It had looked like the young Pole, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, he's been in great form this year, and it looked like he might hold on and win Tirreno. He was favourite going into it, actually, but he's come up short a little bit in the climbs, and Contador has looked like the Contador of old, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, it was interesting being on Paris-Nice and being in the press room while the Col d'Ez stage was going on, and there was a bit of a time difference between Tirreno Adriatico, which was coming to a close before Paris-Nice's final stage really reached the crucial last sort of 40k, and everyone in the press room had a moody internet feed up looking at the pictures from Tirreno because of this crazy climb, the 30% climb. And the general consensus was that it was just a bit of a circus, really. It wasn't conducive to great, it wasn't conducive to great racing. It was just kind of survival of the strongest, and Contador was clearly the strongest. He is good on that kind of...
He was aggressive all stage, wasn't he? I mean, he didn't just leave it to the last time up the climb.
Well, no, but I mean, I hadn't actually seen him go away in the move. But obviously, to be up there to have the 2 and a bit minute gap on everybody else, you know, it does sort of raise the question of whether or not people were really alert to the danger that he posed, whether they really were taking him as seriously as perhaps they have done, you know, in the past. But certainly on that climb, he looked the best. I mean, he didn't look great because it was, you know, it was crazy, and he was still weaving from left to right to try and even out the gradient a bit. But he was by far the most impressive on that climb.
Yeah, he looks like his pride has been stung in a good way from his team's point of view by the criticism from Tinkoff probably last year. And, you know, they seem to have found a sort of easy or maybe an uneasy truce, and they seem to be working in the right in the same direction now. He looks transformed compared to last year, certainly. He looks like he's back to, you know, the Contador of sort of 2009, 2008. And they've got a very strong team. Kreuziger is also absolutely rejuvenated on Saturday's stage. He was he went away on his own, sort of teed Contador up, turning a huge, huge gear. Reminded me a bit of Luc Leblanc on that last climb, just churning an absolutely enormous gear. And he will be very strong lieutenant for Contador. I mean, it's easy to forget that he finished fifth in last year's Tour de France. People still talk about Roman Kreuziger as a kind of unfulfilled, his unfulfilled promise, but he could still be a rider who is in the ascendant.
Yeah, and Nicholas Roach as well, of course. They have built a fairly strong team, and I think Roach's main target this year is a Giro, isn't it? But at the Tour, they do have, you know, a strong old team to take on Sky. And Contador, I think, yeah, pride stung a little bit. Perhaps also at Tirreno, you know, the aggression owed something to the fact that he was nervous of Kwiatkowski. And Kwiatkowski, as I say, has emerged. He's 23 years old. He's a huge talent. He looks like he can do everything. He looks like he has all the kind of tricks that Contador has. He's a very strong time trialist. He looks like he can hold his own in the climbs. And perhaps Contador just wanted to, you know, show to him that it wasn't going to be quite as straightforward as he thought it might be, and assert himself. And I mean, one of the impressive, love him or hate him or however you feel about Contador, because he is a bit of a divisive figure, obviously given his past and the fact he served a doping ban. But he's always been somebody who tends to be very aggressive in races. He doesn't ride many races where he's not riding to win. You know, and even last year didn't have a good season, but right at the Tour of Oman onwards, he was aggressive. He was riding to win, and that's great to see. And he has sort of lit up Tirreno, I guess.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So moving on to Milan San Remo, the first sort of big classic of the season, the first monument. Route changes and all the rest of it. It's a very open race, isn't it? Hard to call. Daniel, what are your thoughts about Milan-San Remo? There seem to be so many riders who could potentially win that, from Nibali all the way to Mark Cavendish, who we've just seen return to winning ways at Tirreno Adriatico.
Yeah, well, I think in theory it really should finish in a sprint with the number of teams, strong teams, who will be certainly very motivated to keep the race together. You think about Quickstep, you think about Lotto Bellisol, and also, well, Cannondale slightly different because they will want to set a really fast pace over the Cipressa, I would imagine, and possibly the Poggio as well, to shell out Cavendish and Greipel. Of course, Kittel's not riding. Giant Shimano have preferred Degenkolb. So I think the big question for me is whether Cannondale can sort of realise that aim of just setting a pace that's too fast for Cavendish and Greipel, because you know there really isn't a lot in that route. We talk about it as the classic San Remo route. It's actually a route that's reverting to what it was before 2008 with no Limagne, so it really is quite a flat route. A lot will depend on the weather as well. It will be hard to attack if there's a headwind, in which there often is on the Poggio and the Cipressa. So there isn't a lot to break it up. Very high likelihood of a substantial group coming into the finish. Whether it's a group of 40 with Peter Sagan or someone like Gerald Sielek, the defending champion, as the fastest rider on paper, or a group of 100 or 80 with Cavendish still in there, that is the essential question, I would say.
If you think back to 2009, the year that Cavendish won it, I remember he was particularly poor in Tirreno Adriatico that year, wasn't he? Did he not pull out the race early?
Well, it was a week-long, fairly elaborate bluff, because he was actually going pretty well. Yeah. He managed to convince the press that he wasn't going well. This year, I get the impression, this week, I mean, he's just won today in Tirreno, I get the impression he's had to cram slightly, he's had to panic train, he's changed his training to accommodate the last-minute change in the San Remo route. the Pompeiana going out, Cavendish realising or it dawning on him that he perhaps could win, and he's done more training on the climbs in the last 3 or 4 weeks than he would otherwise have done. But he still looks like he might be a bit short. I mean, he was last yesterday in the stage to the Muro di Guardia Grele. But having said that, he did say it was just an exceptionally bad day and one of those sort of freak days on the bike, and it might not be indicative of poor form in general.
I mean, it was very hard to judge from his sprint win in Tirreno what kind of form he's in, because Greipel and others fell off or were held up by a late crash, including Peter Sagan. I mean, in the end, Cavendish only really had to beat his lead-out man, Alessandro Petacchi. He just had to get round him, really, to win the stage. Hard to tell what kind of form he's in. He did say afterwards, he did make a point afterwards of saying that the previous day it was the worst he'd ever felt. And I wonder if that is part of the bluff again, because there's always almost a sense with Cavendish that, you know, if he shows good form this week, if he wins lots of stages, then it teams are scared of him in Milan-San Remo. There's more, you know, think back to 2009, there weren't any teams organised at that time to try and get rid of him, and he held on. You know, whereas if Cervelo at the time, say, for example, had tried to get rid of him, perhaps Henrik Hausler would have won the race.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost, and I think back to 2012 as well in the Olympic Games, and I think his failure at the Olympic Games possibly owed something to the incredible form he showed at the end of the tour, where the stage on the Friday into Brive and then on the Sunday into Paris, he looked in as good form as he'd ever been in. And I think that made other teams like Germany and so on very unwilling to work with Great Britain at the Olympic Road Race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this time in Milan-San Remo, there is one major thorn in his side, and it's not the likelihood of someone like Philippe Gilbert or Vincenzo Nibali attacking on the Cipressa and the Poggio. I actually think that might be a good thing for him if a lot of attacks start going on the Cipressa, because it's likely to come back together and there will be a stagnation period. The big thorn in his side is Cannondale, because they will have a single aim. They will want to drill it on the Cipressa. They want to set as high a rhythm as possible up there. And with the aim of, if not dropping him definitively there, then certainly tiring him to the extent where he will really struggle on the Poggio. And I think that is his big, big problem. And I don't know how Quick Step will plan to counteract that. I mean, what we'll probably see them do is try and lead it out into the Cipressa, so he's already at the front of the bunch. And by the Cipressa is not a hard climb. It's 7 kilometres long. You know, it takes you 3 or 4 kilometres to fall all the way back through the group. And, you know, he might be in last place in the main bunch halfway up the Cipressa, but, you know, he's only got 3 or 4 kilometres to do then. And, you know, he might still be within 10, 20 seconds of the peloton over the top of the Cipressa.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the race is going to certainly revert back to the sort of Milan-San Remo we used to see in the early 2000s, before the introduction of Le Manier in 2008. Incidentally, Cavendish won in 2009, 2008 with Eric Zabor's last year as a professional. He had won 4 Milan-San Remos, could have been 5. He got caught just on the line. He put his arms up to celebrate and Oscar Freire pipped him. But throughout the whole of that decade, really, it really had become the sprinter's classic, because, and that was what prompted the organisers, I guess, to put Le Manier in. But the first year that they introduced it, in 2008, Zabel's last year as a professional, he finished 4th, I think it was. And then in 2009, he pretty much coached Cavendish on positioning. They rode the last 120 kilometres or so of the course a couple of times. And Zabel was explaining to Cavendish exactly where he needed to be in the group in order to, exactly as you say, Daniel, give himself that buffer so that when the pace was on at the front, he'd slip back, sure, but he wouldn't slip back to you know, be in any danger of getting dropped. I saw Eric Zabel at Paris-Nice, and I wanted to get his impressions on the character of Milan-San Remo and the various route changes over the years, and whether he feels that the organisers are somewhat picking on sprinters by changing the course and trying to make it harder.
There's been several course changes to Milan-San Remo over the years. They put La Mani climb in during your time, I think, as a racer. And then they proposed to put in the Pompeiana climb, which has now been taken out because the road surface is not so good. What do you think makes a classic Milan-San Remo?
First of all, I guess it's the distance. nearly 300 kilometers. And of course, over the years, the organization tried to make the race a little bit harder, because the groups at the finish becoming bigger and bigger. So I guess at the time of great Eddie Merckx, they put Cipressa and Poggio in, and then yeah, in the last years, I guess in 2008, the Lemani comes in. So now it's more or less a little bit like before. No Lemani, no Pompeiana, only Cipressa and Poggio. But I guess the racers or the riders makes the race hard or not, and yeah, depends on how fast and how hard they go.
You did a little gesture there when you said only Cipressa and Poggio, because they're not easy climbs, are they? Especially for the sprinter types.
That's right. I won that race 4 times, and honestly, every year I was on my absolutely limit on the Cipressa and on the Poggio, because great finishers, yeah, attackers, climbers try to attack there, and that makes it hard to follow.
You coached Mark Cavendish in the run-up to the year he won, and he's the classic sprinter. Everyone thinks he can't climb, but you, what kind of work did you do with him on the climbs, the Lemani and Cipressa? Was it a case of trying to make him aware of his positioning on those climbs so that he wouldn't put himself too much into the red?
Yes, that's true. We, I give him, just tips how I act in this race, and how was my tactic, and then we did it before the race. We did the recon 2 times on the last 100 kilometers, and then it's just a different feeling when you are on the bike. And then, for example, there's a few points like very important points, like key points for the race, and it's always good to know that before, and to then you can expect what will come, and that's good to know it before. And then yeah, Cavendish had a great day in 2009, and Mark won his first Milan San Remo, and that was at the end 99% Cavendish, and the rest was the team around him.
In terms of being a sprinter on the Poggio, ideally when you go over the top before the descent, where do you want to be?
The entrance in the Poggio is very important, especially when you are not a super climber. So it's always good to be in the first 5 or first 10 at least. And then it's a fast climb, and with the corners, even uphill you have sometimes to brake before the corners, because they are going so fast in the final. And then there is around 1.4 or 1 kilometer till the top. There is a key point where all the great champions set an attack. I remember Jalabert or Von der Riest. And if you can survive this point, then you have as a fast rider, you have a great chance to be still there, or to come back in the descent and to make your sprint.
And how important are teammates for you in that final sprint? Because unlike in the Tour, where there will be a train to lead you in, you may not necessarily have as many teammates in a position to help in the final.
Yes, it's not realistic to think about when you start with 8 riders that you have all 8 between Cipressa and Poggio still together in the first group. So most of the time you have to count with about 50%, so 4 riders. And then it's always good to use one in the positioning before the podio, so use him as a lead-out rider for the entrance. And then if you have still three together, then it's just a question of the legs. If all these three can survive the climb, and then if you have at least one in the last kilometer, that's a good scenario.
So the entrance to the Poggio is almost like a first sprint, and then the line, yeah, the finish line is a second sprint.
Yeah, it's like a long time countdown. So it begins at Cabo Berta, and then first really important goal is the entrance of the Cipressa, then to being good enough to survive the Cipressa, and then the entrance of the Poggio, and then survive there, and then still good enough to be in the first group for the sprint.
And lastly, this year, do you think the course is perfectly set up for a sprinter again?
Yes, maybe last time.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
So that was Eric Zabel there talking about Milan Sanremo, a race he won four times. During Paris-Nice, I also spoke to Simon Gerrans of the Orica Green Edge team, the Australian national champion. Won Milan Sanremo a couple of years ago when he was in a pretty stellar group, really. He was with Nibali and Cancellara at the finish, and he outsprinted them both after playing quite a clever game of poker, really. He was the sort of he was the least likely to win it, really, and he kind of lured Cancellara into doing more work in the final stages than perhaps the Swiss rider would have liked. But he made the point that it's not just Mark Cavendish who's had to change his spring training with an eye on Milan Sanremo. He also has had to adjust, because he went and looked at the Pompeiana climb, which the organisers had inserted into the route, and I asked him about his impressions of the Pompeiana and whether the organisers were right to take it out at such short notice. Simon, there's been a lot of talk about the Milan-Sanremo route changing. They put in the climb of the Pompeiana and then they took it out again. Had you had a chance to go and look at that climb?
Yeah, I did. I a few weeks ago, it was still rumoured that it might be taken out, I rode down there and had a look at it, and rode the whole climb and most of the descent. And I think I got to within about 300 or 400 metres of the bottom of the descent, and that's where the landslides were and the road was shut. So I had to turn around and ride back up it and over it the opposite direction again. But yeah, since then we've found out they've taken it out of the race, and we're just going back along the coast like normal.
Do you think it's the correct decision, having seen the road? A lot of people talking about the surface not being great either. What's your thoughts on it?
Oh, for sure, it wasn't the best of roads across the top of the climb, actually, after you go through the town of Pompeiana. But, as far as whether it was the right decision or not, that's really not my call. Obviously, I would have liked to have seen the climb in there to make the race a little bit more selective. But, I think there's bigger things to deal with than that. At the end of the day, they had to, I guess, go with what the local councils wanted to do.
Obviously, it means also Lamani's not in there, which is one of the climbs that was in the race the year you won it. Do you think it will be less selective this time because it reverts almost back to the traditional kind of sprinter's course?
Well, actually, I heard a rumour this morning that maybe the Magnani was back in, so it's sort of changing on a weekly basis at the moment. But, it's definitely, as it stands at the moment, it's not near as selective as it has been in the past, and not near as selective as it would have been if the Pompeiana was in there. And I see it as sort of being 90% chance of being a bunch of good sprinters still there contesting for the win this year. So for a guy like myself, it definitely makes it a lot more difficult to win.
You said that with a bit of a smile on your face there, but surely as a professional rider and one of the former winners of the race, not knowing the course before one of the monuments of cycling, it's far from ideal, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course. It's like, a lot of guys have been preparing for the course that was sort of the initial course for quite some time, and to have that completely turned on its head just by eliminating one climb makes it a lot more difficult. And then you have the likes of, say, Mark Cavendish, who didn't even have Milan Sanremo on his radar, I don't think, and all of a sudden he's back in the team. So, yeah, it does put a big question mark over how you prepare for the race, but everyone's in the same situation, I guess.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Okay, so that's just about us for this week. finally, all we have is a competition to win a signed Garmin Sharp jersey, signed with by all the riders who competed in Paris-Nice for Garmin Sharp. And the question is, name the podium for Milan-San Remo. Predict, should I say, the podium for Milan-San Remo. We don't want you to name the podium after the race. Predict in advance of the race who's going to finish first, second and third in Milan-San Remo. And if you can tweet your prediction with the hashtag #HumansInventComp, that's #HumansInventComp, very important to include that in your tweet. Either the first one or that, if there are several correct entries, one will be picked out of the hat for the Garmin Sharp signed jersey. So thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.